This is Off Stage and On the Air, performance number 532. I am Lisa Sheps, and I am joined with by guest co-host, the incredible Adam Roberts. Say hello, Adam.
Hello, Adam.
You are listening to us on KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby, streaming live on KOOP.org. You better stay right where you are.
Hurry, hurry, step right up. The show's about to begin. Forget your troubles and raise your cup. Yeah. Step right up. Feast your eyes on the wonders of this world. Oh, yeah.
Five, six, seven, eight.
It is Wednesday, September 4th, 2019. On the show today, we are joined by Hyde Park Theater and their show Hot Dogs at the Eiffel Tower, or Le Tower Eiffel. Also, Broadway Across America and their show Les Miserables, keeping with the French theme. And of course, we'll have lively discussions of the world of theater in Austin, New York, Paris, and Liverpool, Ohio. Stick with us.
God, I need this job. I've got to get this job.
I've got to get this job.
Lovely. First Adam, show I ever saw on tour.
Really?
In Pittsburgh.
Did you, or did, was anybody of note in it? I'm guessing no.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, you know, I for the majority of my time in New York City, it was playing, and I never saw it till probably a few months before it closed.
No way.
And let me tell you something. My child, that was a tired production by then. It was very tired.
Well, you know,
poor thing was on its last legs.
The
indeed,
last
it,
legs.
It did lead. Indeed, it, yes, it's ba da ba da 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 fall flat.
You know,
da 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 fall flat. So, welcome to the show.
Well, I am so
you
thrilled
have co-hosted
to be here.
With me before, have you not?
I have never co-hosted with you.
Oh my God, I'm so thrilled.
The very first time I was on the show, though, Sarah Marie Curry was the co-host.
Ah, I remember when she did that. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Many moons ago.
Many, many moons ago. You know, we've been on the air for 10 years.
10 years.
Which I started when I was 5.
Was that your sorority name?
It was. No, that was the name of my first book. Let's introduce the folks that are here with us. We have a relatively small crowd for Offstage and On the Air. So mm-hmm. It's a small but mighty crowd here, which I love. Maggie Gallant, welcome back to the show.
Bonjour, allô.
Bonjour, mon ami. And Ken Webster, bonjour.
Bonjour.
Okay. Bonjour, as we say in Texas.
Bonjour.
So that little piece of music that we played at the very beginning, I'm assuming that everybody recognizes it since we talked about the show itself. Mm-hmm. Chorus Line.
A Chorus Line.
A Chorus Line. And there's the reason why I played this piece from A Chorus Line, and this was the 2006
revival.
Cast, revival. Mm-hmm. Is because what's-his-name, Ryan Murphy, mm-hmm. Is doing a 10-part miniseries.
Really?
Based on Chorus Line.
Hmm.
Bum-pa-bum-pa-bum-pa, Chorus Line!
I'm very excited about that.
He does some incredible stuff.
He does.
So he's doing a 10-part miniseries, and of course we know that there was a very ill-fated movie of A Chorus Line starring Alison Lang.
And Michael Douglas.
And oh, yeah. What, did he play Zach?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it didn't do very well. And Alison Lang, ooh, she was in my show, Oh Brother.
Oh.
And she was just doing, her career was like going up until Chorus Line.
A Chorus Line.
Poor thing.
Long
it's not
point.
Alison Lang. What's her last name? Alison somebody. How do y'all feel about Chorus Line? Have you seen it?
I have never seen A Chorus Line.
No.
I've seen clips, lots of clips.
You're like me. I hadn't seen it. I've only seen it the one time.
I haven't either.
I remember when I learned for the first time that it was based on like real life people.
Yes.
And that it was like a devised musical at the Public. And that was very exciting because I had not known that.
Except we didn't call it devised back then. It was a workshop.
It was a workshop.
I knew a lot of those people.
Did you?
My friend Andy Bue, who I still know, mm-hmm. He was the one at the very beginning that said, I'm not going to do this. I'm going to go be a stage manager and director.
Yes.
That's my friend Andy. And Wayne Cilento,
yeah.
I knew him relatively well. So that was good. I actually reintroduced myself to Wayne Cilento when I went to see Wicked
mm-hmm.
during their previews in San Francisco. And he was rather surprised to see the new me.
Was he?
Yes. He said, you've changed.
You're different.
So here's some interesting stuff that I want to talk about. We're going to get kind of heady, and then which I think is very interesting. So there's an article in a website called citylab.com talking about the changing geography of America's creative class.
Mm.
And we hear a lot about the creative class in business.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a group of people, and I will just include the four of us in that class, but it's also game designers and a lot of the tech people that are designing a lot of the stuff that's in the tech world these days. But the creative class is the class of people that cities talk about, advertise as bringing other people in. So the creative class is a class of people that is a good class of people to have in your city, and therefore attracting other people and businesses into your city. Austin is in the top 10 of the creative class. DC is the top. But the other cities, it goes Washington, DC, Seattle, San Francisco, Austin, and Boston rank top 10, not only in the leading city, but also the leading metro areas.
Well, it's interesting because there's this book, The Rise of the Creative Class.
Yes,
Richard
read it.
Florida, did you?
Mm-hmm.
And so you know that Austin, way back, like 20 years ago when it was written or whatever, was one of the five cities that he sort of case studied as being on the brink of this creative classdom.
Yeah, and it's interesting that in keeping with the Texas cities, Arlington, I don't know why they mentioned Arlington and El Paso are among the lowest.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. And Houston and Dallas are down in the bottom rankings.
Hmm.
They're not, yeah, which I found interesting.
Interesting.
But here's where I throw out my frustration to cities like Austin that are spending so much time and effort trying to capitalize on having a large amount of creatives in their city. The city itself doesn't do a lot to support the creative class as it comes to theater. Specifically, and some other groups as well, theater, dance, and so I find that a little frustrating. Hmm. How do y'all feel?
It would be great if we somehow could get more spaces.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, in the city, as someone who opened a space in the past 6 years, the city does not make it easy. As a matter of fact, if I were to do it again and do it by the book, which I didn't, I wouldn't be able to do it.
Wow.
They don't make it easy. They make it quite frankly difficult, if not impossible, to open new spaces unless you have a lot of money and a lot of time.
Hmm.
So, yeah, agreed.
Well, and then they take away the ones. I mean, like when Salvage Vanguard went, I mean, what is even happening to that building? I mean, it's just,
right.
It then just becomes a...
It's a restaurant and a development
office. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, which they can get a lot of money. I know that even in the space where Ground Floor Theater is now, I'm talking to my landlord, and what he's getting now versus what he got when I came in is more than 100% higher than it was when I first moved in. So, because we're trying to get more space.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to think about like defining what creative means, because as a person from the arts, I know I immediately jumped to those things. And then when I was reading that, you know, part about Austin in the book and was so surprised to see that the arts weren't really covered a whole lot in that section, you know, and kind of reimagining what that word means is.
Well, the creative class, I think from a business standpoint, mm-hmm. thinking more like our creative directors and ad agencies and things like this that are making a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
But when you take these companies that hire those people, like you know, all the high tech companies, Google mm-hmm. and Facebook and whatnot, they're touting to these employees that there's a creative city
right.
behind this right. creative class. So mm-hmm. there is high culture and arts that are available for you to see.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right. The creative class from a business standpoint doesn't necessarily mean us.
It's interesting.
So speaking of that, I'm always excited when I see local people in the New York Times. And I don't know if y'all saw this, but there was an article called Retreating for the Summer, but Not Heading Backwards, talking about five theater makers, what they did during the summer to create the crest. And there, when I looked in it, on the fourth one was Adrian Dawes in the New York Times. And it highlighted what Adrian did during this summer, when she had a fellowship in Muncie, Indiana, at a theater called Ply Space, where she worked on her show, which is now called Harry and Sherry. But I'm so thrilled to
it's
see
fantastic.
To
oh,
see
amazing.
A local person. And she mentions Austin in the. She wrote this quite a bit. So, three cheers to Adrian Dawes, who's been on this show several times.
Phenomenal,
yeah.
Love it.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's the end of that. There's also another thing that I thought was very interesting, which was a organization called Maestra. Have you heard of this? It's about musicians.
I have not.
I had not
but
either.
I'm excited to.
And I'm surprised that I hadn't heard about it before. But it is an organization that works with women in the music business and musical arts.
Amazing.
Specifically, hold on, I've got their mission statement right here. It was founded by a composer, lyricist, and musical director, Georgia Stitt. She wanted to give
That's Jason Robert Brown's wife, Georgia.
Is that right? I did not know that. To give support, visibility, and community to the women who make up the musical theater industry.
Amazing.
And what caught my eye about this is they have a series of Women Who Wowed Us, a 9 or 10 week series. And they were highlighting a woman named Emily Grishman, who is a copyist. And a copyist is was a art form that had gone away with the advent of computers and things like this. But it was something I did not know until I started working on my first Broadway musical when the composer composes, and this is, you probably know this better than anybody, composer composes it, which is really just the libretto or the music for piano and conductor and
vocals.
Yeah,
chicken scratch sort of.
And then the orchestrator takes that and splits it up amongst the different
instruments.
And then the copyist hand copies from the orchestrators each individual part. So the flautist only gets the flute part. And they take that from the orchestrator's thing. What I didn't realize until I read this just now, that they have some leeway to fix the problems in the orchestrations.
Oh, yeah. It's a very, you know, by the time a musical hits, there have been many, many hands.
Right.
Many more hands than people, I think. And you'll see her name on a lot of on the bottom of a lot of copied
did you
music?
Recognize her name?
Absolutely.
She's got 100 in her IBDB page is 185 Broadway shows that she's done. It's pretty amazing, and it's set up as an interview, and it's I don't think they edited it because it seems exactly like word for word. It's really it's interesting, but I thought I truly thought with the advent of computers that most of this stuff would be done with a computer and not by hand anymore.
A lot of times that people will sit sort of in the room while it's being developed, you know, or while changes are being made with a computer open to make changes in finale and things. And it's an interesting
trajectory.
But
I know that, you know, during O Brother, my friend Dean was a copyist but there was no computers involved.
Sure.
It was all done by hand. And reading this article, it sounds like it still is handwritten.
There is some times that you'll see that. I actually, one of my tattoos is the old piano conductor font from the copyists.
For those of you who didn't see, looking on the webcam, there was Adam's tattoo. But I think it's, so that's not a profession that is losing ground because of technology.
I would say no. I would say that it's, one of those parts of the theater has survived that despite seeming like it would be archaic.
Yeah. Now, here's an interesting thing that I didn't really think about, but after I read the answer to this thing, it was like, oh, of course, duh. It's like the copyist helps with the page turns.
Sure.
Didn't even think of that. Mm-hmm. So explain what I mean when I say that.
Well, you know, when you're sitting down and you're sort of working on how the how a person is going to read their orchestration, you know, part of the editing process of that is you don't want to put a page turn in the middle of a very difficult technical passage. And so that's the responsibility of the copyist, who is an editor very much, you know.
Right. And that's what she said here as mm-hmm. well, is like, you know, I will never change the content,
right?
But I act like an editor on a. But I will interpret the intent. Or there will be times that the orchestrator will have done something but didn't carry it through to all the other
absolutely.
Parts, and she will do that.
Yeah, very much like an editor.
Yeah,
it's mm-hmm. fascinating.
Yeah, you had the same aha moment. Like, duh, yeah. That makes complete sense.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so that's fascinating.
They can also be really good eyes, for instance, if you have, maybe there's a clef that was mistaken or something, and they'll be like, I'm pretty sure you didn't mean this, to the orchestrator. Let's talk about it, you know? So it's a good second pair of eyes to have as well.
And what I also found interesting, they asked, the question was, how closely do you work with the composer? And she basically said, not at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which you would think that you would, you know, just from a PR, yes, I work right alongside of Stephen Sondheim. I'm his right hand. Right. But they're not, because there's at least one, you know, there's an arranger, a dance arranger, mm-hmm. all that between the copyist
and
them.
So many hands.
But this was such an aha moment for me today, as it was back in 81 when mm-hmm. when I met Dean and saw what he was doing in terms of copying. And I said, really? You copy like meticulously every single note?
It's a really interesting person. Personality typically who has that position.
Kind of nerdy, yet very creative.
Sure.
Yeah.
Academic.
Yeah. Yeah. So there'll be a link on our site, offstageonair.com, to this interview. And three cheers for this group, Maestro.
Absolutely.
I did not know it existed. And
well, Georgia is very active in sort of promoting lots of causes in the Broadway community. So that's awesome that she's doing that.
Yep. Yeah. And of course, the end of the interview says, why is Maestro a good thing? Oh, also, the other thing I did not realize, and of course I should have, because, again, of my personal experience, the copyists are covered by Local 802, the mm-hmm. AFMM, mm-hmm. American Federations of Musicians, mm-hmm. which I thought they would have had their own. Yeah, that wasn't necessarily, when I think of a musician, right or wrong, I think of somebody, you know,
playing
the tuba.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Like, nope.
All musicians play tuba.
All under that same umbrella.
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Let's see what else interesting things I want to talk about. We'll talk about this. Merrily We Roll Along. Mm-hmm.
New film coming out in 20 years.
In 20 years. So I don't know how I feel about this. So Merrily We Roll Along, Stephen Sondheim musical that opened, by the way, we keep coming back to Oh Brother.
Yeah.
But they were right across the street from us.
Oh, were they?
We were at the Anta and they were at the one across the street. And we were the two flops. Mm-hmm. We were the two shows heading for the cliff.
How long were you open for?
Three shows.
Oh, okay.
They were open for 2 weeks.
They still beat you, I was going to say.
We opened on Tuesday. We closed Wednesday night. Richard Linklater, mm-hmm. Austin, known most recently, I don't know if it's most recently now, but for apropos to this.
Boyhood.
Boyhood, mm-hmm. which he shot over a 12-year period. So Merrily We Roll Along, as most of our listeners probably know, is a show that takes place over 20 years, and it travels backwards. They start when they're in their 40s, and they end when they're in their 20s. Mm-hmm. It's actually quasi-autobiographical for Sondheim. So he's taking the same approach. So he's going to take 20 years to do it. Ben Platt is going to be playing Charlie, mm-hmm. which I think is amazing.
I do too.
Bernie Feldenstein and Blake Jenner round out the cast. But I don't know how I feel about this. First of all, there's so many things that go wrong. Richard Linklater's 59 right now.
Yeah.
So he'll be 79 when mm-hmm. he's editing. Mm-hmm.
It'll be very meta. Yeah. It's interesting because, you know, there's...
I won't be here, by the way.
I don't know. I don't know.
Think I'll be
I don't
here.
Know. We'll watch it together.
No.
I have hope.
Deal.
It's interesting because I think that there's, you know, that's one of those shows that gets so much controversy in the musical theater sort of literature. Is the show itself flawed, or was it, you know, so much of the process? And, you know, it's based on a Kaufman and Hart play. So, you know, just kind of trajectory of
Well, and it's never, it had an off-Broadway revival. It's never, no major revival has been successful.
Right.
So that it, one would assume that. That one would think that it's flawed, but it's got a huge following. Lots of people.
I think
this
it's
show.
The best Sondheim score, personally.
There's some very beautiful subjective, music
but,
in that
yeah,
piece.
Really is.
But I think it's going to be. I don't know how I feel about it. I'm mad because there's a decent chance that I won't be around to see it. I love the idea of it, but that's just, you know, that's kind of, he's kind of teasing us a little bit.
A little bit of a tease.
Yeah.
It's true. Yep. Did you like Boyhood?
I did. I liked it a lot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I loved it too. Yeah. And that just seemed like such a massive undertaking.
Yes.
But then another 8 years on top of that.
Yeah.
Now, there are no numbers in that musical that happen. It does happen backwards, but chronological.
Correct.
So there's nothing that marries the time frames.
Right. In there. Right. Nope. It just goes straight back.
And they made the choice in the 80s to they had a bunch of unknowns. One of them was Jason Alexander, amongst others. They wore very nondescript costumes.
Just shirts?
With shirts, yeah.
But I think a lot of those decisions were made. There's a really interesting documentary. It's called, I'm going to mess it up, but
yeah,
The Best Little Thing That Never Happened or something.
Yeah, it
that
came
Lonnie
out about
Price.
4 or 5 years ago. It was amazing. Mm-hmm.
And it's all about like sort of watching your heroes stumble, as they say, you know.
Yeah. So I'm very mixed.
Yeah.
But what I'm not mixed about, speaking of Sondheim, is Company.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. Everybody's very excited.
Yeah. So this is, to refresh folks' memory, this is the Company that basically it's the production from the West End where Bobby is not B-O-B-B-Y, but B-O-B-B-I-E, played by a female. In this case, dun-da-da-dun, Katrina Link. I'm in love with Katrina Link.
It's going to be, I think, take it by storm. I really do.
And, of course, Patti LuPone.
Patti LuPone.
Minor character.
Yeah.
Patti LuPone getting first billing, even though the role is not all that first.
Sure. Well, and certainly, you know, the marketing campaigns and things are highlighting.
So this was directed in London and will be directed here by Marion Elliott, who did War Horse and The Curious Incident. I found interesting. I did not know this till I read this, that the conceit of this is everything takes place in Bobby's head. It's not real.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Company is one of those shows that could be so dated, but that keeps coming back. It just keeps having lives and lives and lives, you know?
I don't think do you really think it can be dated? And because the themes that run through it are universal.
Sure. I guess I'm talking from a musical perspective. Like that original score is so of its time. And I think that it's just great how it's been able to have new lives to match, you know.
Well, but at the same time, you talk the score specifically. I mean, whether you go the documentary about creating the cast album, it just the score itself has a history.
It does.
Beyond the piece.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'm so looking forward to it. When I heard it was Katrina Link, I
very
had an accident in my pants. It was just it's so exciting.
Yes, agreed.
But yeah, I never saw Company on Broadway. Did you?
No,
me neither. Okay. Speaking of Hercules in the Park.
Hercules in the Park.
Yeah, they added another show. So this is part of the which they've always gotten a lot of praise for it. I don't know how long. I don't think they've been doing it very long. Less than 10 years, I think.
The park is
the public,
like public
works. Yeah, okay. It's called the Public Works. And it's where they take shows and they use people from nonprofits. The casts are usually very large, numbering in the 100s, most of which are not professional performers. And this was done as well. This the Public Works founder is Lear de Bessonnet.
Oh, wow.
Wow. We're sticking with the French.
I was going to say, so much French today.
Yeah. But what I found interesting is so this is the Free Theater in the Park at the Del Court in New York City. And this year they did, you know, normally you sit in line there. You go and you have a picnic and you stand in line. But they had a lottery. Very similar to the Hamilton lottery for people to get tickets because it was that much in demand.
Wow.
And one of the podcasts I listened to, everybody that these people knew, they all lived in New York. Nobody got tickets.
Wow.
Yeah, so it was evidently
high
demand.
That's crazy.
So they added another day. So today, they've added a show tonight. It closes on Sunday. It only plays for a week.
Wow. Good for them.
Yeah. And this is the Herc. They added some numbers for it.
Oh, they did.
Tom Kitt of Next to Normal fame, as well as Alan Menkel and David Zippel.
Boy, that's a trio right there.
Yeah. Anyway, Hercules.
Amazing.
Then the final thing I want to talk about, just very briefly, there was an article in New York Times that said, Discount Me In, How I Saw 30 Shows on a Student Budget. And this is a person that had a job as an intern of the New York Times, not a theater person, not a theater, even aficionado, and decided they were going to see a lot of shows. So they basically, she said, her name is Sarah Bahr, B-A-H-R. In between fine-tuning stories for White House correspondent Maggie Haberman and the New York Yankees beat writer James Wagner, I spent my nights nestled in Broadway theaters. She never paid more than $70 for a show.
Oh.
Most of her tickets cost $40. And she did things like she lined up in the box office for the tickets that are left over. Sometimes standing in line for hours in the morning. She got standing room tickets to Chicago and Come Four Away. She got some free tickets because she hung out with Ben Brantley and Laura Collins.
Okay, well.
Then she got cheap student tickets to My Fair Lady, Inc., Fairview and All My Sons for $12.
Did she do any like TKTS or
she did not
any
say
of those?
She did any of that.
Interesting.
But what she said was, and it took me a while to figure this out, she's coming from the standpoint of not a theater person. And she was gripped by the storytelling of theater. Very much because she's a writer. And it was, that was her biggest thing. For what I said, one of the things she wrote, a standout theatrical production accomplishes the same. In the title role of Dear Evan Hansen, Andrew Barth Feldman made me forget where I was, who I was, that I was anything other than part of the world on stage, which I think is just amazing.
I think it's the coolest thing to have people who are not necessarily from a genre, you know, light up.
Yeah. And here's the part I don't understand. She wasn't a fan of The Ferryman, which I don't get.
Interesting.
I saw it. It's amazing. I don't know. She was also not a fan of Be More Chill, even though she fell in love with the recording of Michael in the Bathroom.
Well, that is sort of the pinnacle song.
Yeah, it is. All right.
What do Broadway tickets run now?
You're going to, for a hit, face value, without paying premium prices, you're going to pay $125 at the cheapest. But here's the deal. Like when I was in New York, I tried to get tickets to it's the one about the court scene. What's his name's in it? To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yes.
I'm thinking there. Like you're looking like you're doing jester moves, and I'm like that kind of court. I was like, what are you talking? I don't know the show you're talking about. That Nathan Lane thing.
Anyway, they had $300 tickets. Obstructed view.
Ow. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I said I don't think so. Yeah. So it's not cheap when you get the big hits with premium seatings. And this I blame squarely on the shoulders of Hamilton. They started this premium ticket thing. If you're going to sit in the orchestra and you don't want an obstructed view, you're going to have to pay more than the top orchestra price, which is different from what it was even Good 5 years ago. Anyway, let's take a little break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to talk to Hyde Park Theater about their show, about eating hot dogs, and about being in Paris. And so let's listen to a little bit of Merrily We Roll Along.
It's not that nothing went wrong.
We are back. You're listening to Offstage and On the Air with Lisa Sheps and Mr. Adam Roberts.
Hey!
And I guess we should say we need to send good words out to Nicole Shiro and her brother, Casey, who is dealing with some medical stuff today. So
Hey, Nicole. Hey, Casey. Nicole.
And we've been having great conversations here with Ken Webster and Maggie Gallant just about general theater stuff. But before we talk about hot dogs in the Eiffel Tower, Maggie, could I ask you to please choose a number between 2 and 53?
47.
47, my favorite number. Let's see what that is.
Howdy, y'all. This is Dale Watson. I gotta go. I'm in the bathroom. Somebody needs to use it. Howdy, y'all. This is Dale Watson, singer, songwriter, and thespian. And you're listening to Offstage and On the Air on KOOP Hornsby, Austin 91.7 FM.
We don't hear him very much.
Thespian. I like that.
Very thespian. Good choice. Because, you know, he was in, I think it was Ghost, the Stephen King, Darkland of Ghostland County, Darkland, Ghostbusters of Darkland County, whatever it was called. I forgot. Nicole's probably desperately.
I was going to say, she would
right
know
now.
This if she
I
were
forgot
here.
What, she definitely would know. Well, I would like to welcome back to the show, Ken Webster. Hi, Ken.
How are you?
And Maggie Gallant.
Thank you. And for the excellent pronunciation of my name.
Only because you told me how to pronounce it before we went on the show.
Giving that away.
I had a lot of different versions.
I was excited when you told me that Ken and Maggie and Hyde Park were on today, I have to tell you.
No,
I love going to Hyde Park. I love going to Hyde Park. That's
me too.
It's just truth.
Moi aussi, yeah, as they say in France.
Yeah, always have.
So hot dogs in the Eiffel Tower. We talked a little bit about it last week because we got our signals crossed. We thought you were coming on last week. Mm-hmm. So I did a little bit of hype and I read the paragraph about what if your mother did blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
True.
Yes. So tell us about this show.
Well, it's about my 40-year-long search for my fabulous French papa.
Oh,
so it deals with themes of belonging, of growing up in a very small English village with a mother who thinks it's okay to knit a bathing suit for you.
Yeah, that was
such
one of the ones we said. That's a true
That's very
story.
True. That is
knit
all too
a bathing
true.
Suit. Oh.
And so it's, I mean, it has some universal themes. It's, you know, it's just belonging and sense of identity, but it also deals with adoption as well. So anyone who's had any experience of that will also find another layer in the piece, but you certainly don't have to have experience of that to enjoy it. And it's funny, mostly.
It is very funny.
So this is an autobiographical one-person show.
It is. And I've actually got, we show some slides, some photographs, some documents, and I actually have a lot of the original documents with me that we talk about. So,
oh,
yes.
That's good. And so is this a show that you have been working on for a long time?
It is. I started writing this a long time ago. In fact, I first did it at the Short Fringe for Frontera Fest. It was a very different piece.
I've not heard of that. The Frontera.
I know. Frontera Fest.
Okay, well, I'm sure I'll learn about that someday.
And then I just kept coming back to it because things kept happening. It's a story that's just evolved. It's not that I just decided to take it out again. It's just things kept happening and I just changed it. And the last big change was in 2017. So here it is. And then I just took it to the Winnipeg Fringe Festival in the summer.
And how did you do it? Was there a competitive nature to the festival?
No, I mean, it's nice. I mean, there are people who are competitive. So when my lovely 5-star review came out, there were a few people who were, hang on, you're the new girl here. This is your first time. But no, on the whole, it's very friendly. There's 180 other shows going on there. So you know, you find some good people.
Mm-hmm. And tell us why you chose this for Hyde Park at this moment in time.
Maggie was going to do it at the Winnipeg Fringe Festival, and she approached me about doing a couple of performances at Hyde Park Theater, kind of as a warm-up before going off to the festival. And somehow, I sometimes get very busy with Frontera Fest. I'm usually directing the show that opens right after Frontera Fest,
right.
So I miss a lot of things at Frontera Fest. So I had never seen any of the incarnations, Short Fringe or Long Fringe of it, that Maggie had done at Frontera Fest. So the first time I saw it was in July, and I just fell in love with it. It's great storytelling, and the structure of it is so great, and it's funny, and it tore me up. When you see it, you'll know which part tore me up.
Which I will, probably next week. So this hasn't opened yet, correct?
Correct.
That's, I believe we heard that the first preview was this evening.
Yes.
Yay!
Yes, yeah, we open tomorrow night officially.
Yeah. So how has it been going? Have you made any changes, substantial or otherwise, since Winnipeg?
No, so this really, working with Ken was the first time that I've worked with a proper theatre director.
Oh, okay.
And it's always very different when you're working on a solo show because, of course, whenever I do it on stage, I mean, I don't make it up as I go along, but I'm fluid. I might change some things here and there.
Right.
So it's been very good to have the discipline of sticking to my script,
yeah,
for one, and also just these small changes. We were talking about it last night, and I said just the small things that Ken's done has dramatically changed it in the way I feel as a performer, and I think the way the audience will perceive it as well. So it's been great, but it hasn't been, okay, we're cutting this whole section and rewriting.
Well, I'll tell you what, as someone...
You're not French anymore.
It's not going to be hot dogs, it's going to be tacos. But, you know, just on the face of things, I would always recommend that somebody have a director. But up to this point, you have not.
No, because when you're just doing a solo show, I mean, this has always just been something that I've done on the side for fun, and I came out of stand-up comedy, and, right, you know, usually you just go by the audience tells you. If it's terrible, you get nothing.
So now that, and of course, we haven't opened, we don't know what the audiences are going to think, but we presume they're going to love it. Of course, they're going to love it. But so when you next develop a one-person show, are you going to do it with a director?
I don't know.
Oh,
I'm actually, I'm working.
That wasn't the answer I was expecting.
I'm working on new pieces. Well, I mean, that's obviously the hope, but it goes through phases, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to, you know, whatever I write, I would want to first just test it out, just get it on its feet and even feel like this is something that I want to do. But I'm working on a new piece for Frontera Fest 2020.
Awesome.
And of course, yeah.
How was that for you, Ken, in terms of directing a piece that was pretty well set? You're working with the playwright and it's autobiographical. How do you approach something like that, just in general?
It's been very different because usually I'm starting from scratch. Mm-hmm. Everybody's starting from scratch, the actors and designers and everything. But this one was so great in July. It's been a much different process, but it's been great working with Maggie because she's a great performer, and
she seems difficult to deal with. If I could just talk to you directly,
such a diva.
Just the structure of this, she's, first of all, it's great material. Her true story is really fantastic, but the way the whole piece is structured is just wonderful. But it's been fun. But I like both ways. I like starting from scratch, and I like having something that's really great pretty much ready to go on day one of rehearsals.
So I have a question. You have a legacy of doing one-person shows, Ken, at Hyde Park. Is there a... I love one-person shows. They're some of my very favorite things I've ever been involved with, either as a creator or director or as an audience member. But I find a lot of people will say, it's one person. I'm not sure if I'm really going to be into that. How do you hear that too?
Yes.
You know, that's very interesting to me because I love it so much, you know?
Sometimes in our marketing, we don't go out of our way to say, it's just one person.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly.
It's a special challenge doing a one person piece, just because it's got to have a little bit more of a dynamic to it than a other piece with multiple people, because you need to hold people's attention. So,
and Maggie definitely does that, and we get to meet a lot of different characters during the course of the play.
True.
She does some great impressions of some of the people from her past.
When I did my previews, I had these little cards that I just asked my audience members to write little notes of support or other things they wanted to tell me. And I had one that said, "So much better than I thought it would be."
Thanks a lot.
There we go.
I'm sure that won't be the only time that I hear that.
So is this performed without an intermission?
Nope.
There is an intermission.
No intermission.
Okay. So, so then the answer was yes.
Yes, there is no intermission.
Yes, we have no
intermission.
So it is a No intermission show. And you open tomorrow night.
Yes.
How long do you play?
We run 5 weekends, Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays at 8 p.m.
Through October 5th, maybe?
Through.
Yep.
I'm always doing plays on our wedding anniversary, Kathy and I.
When is your wedding?
Oh. October 5th, closing night. October 5th.
Well, you know, you're 3 days after my birthday, too. So there you go. I assume you're playing at Hyde Park Theater. Where can folks go to get more information?
HydeParkTheater.org, our lovely website.
Excellent. Well, thank you guys so much for coming in. I understand y'all aren't going to be able to stick around and go with us backstage, or are you?
I can.
Maggie can. Great. Yes. Perfect. So yeah. Maggie will stay backstage. Yay. Ken, thank you for coming on.
Mm-hmm. We'll thank you so much for having us.
Great. That was Maggie Gallant and Ken Webster of Hyde Park's Theater, Hot Dogs at the Eiffel Tower by Maggie Gallant. Play September 5th through October 5th at Hyde Park Theater. For more information, HydeParkTheater.org. And last week I had a song all set up called The Hot Dog Song. This time I decided to go with Paris. So I just want to very quickly talk about some local stuff. Paper Chairs next week is opening a show called Plano.
Plano.
Indeed, it is about Plano. Hmm. And it is happening at Ground Floor Theater. They are building the set right now, which looks amazing. So I, of course, did not bring any information about the show. So I'm just going to tell folks to go to paperchairs.org or do a Google search for Plano and Paper Chairs. The other thing I wanted to talk about is Waverly Gallery, the Alchemy Theater Company at the Master George Theater, is happening September 12th through October 4th. You can get information at thealchemytheater.org. And
where is that
space?
Have
you done the Waverly Gallery? It seems like...
No. I love him. But I have not... we almost did Lobby Hero. But got the rights to A Doll's House Part 2, so we put
Hero on
the shelf.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, Waverly Gallery looks interesting. The Master George Theater, I keep forgetting where it is. It's on Pedernales, 130 Pedernales. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's, I believe, part of, I forgot the person's name, Acting Studio. Who is
Carol Hickey.
Carol Hickey's dance studio, yes. Mm-hmm. Correct. But that looks interesting. Let's do Today in Theater History, shall we?
Let's do it.
1909, I was just very young at this time. This is the death of Clyde Fitch.
Oh.
Yeah.
I mean,
Knew him well. Never heard of him. But he was one of the most prolific and successful playwrights of the era.
Oh.
He wrote Captain Jinx of the Horse Marines.
Oh, it's one of my favorites ever.
Beau Brummel.
Yeah.
Barbara Fidici, Sappho, The City, The Cowboy and the Lady, and many others. Hmm. Dead in 1909. I'm guessing if we were around in 1909, and I wasn't, we probably would have heard of all
probably.
Of those things.
Probably, yeah.
In 1922... show Sally, Irene, and Murray opened. It ran for 313 performances.
Ooh.
I searched for this one to try to play a little piece of it. Couldn't find it. But they have plucky heroines named Sally, Irene, and Mary.
Oh. Okay, well, they were plucky.
There you go. So in 1999, at this time, a little show called Urinetown ended its 1 week expansion at the New York International Fringe Festival. And during that week, there was only one play happening during the festival, and it was called Urinetown.
Wow.
Because they extended a week from the festival, which I think is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
And of course, it went on to have an off-Broadway run and a Broadway run. And
I didn't know that started in the festival.
Yeah, it did. And from what I understand, they were really trying. Am I thinking of the right show? Yeah, trying to find like the worst thing that they could do.
Ah, fascinating.
Little did they know.
Such a great show.
Yeah, and this I did not know was a show. In 2003, off Broadway, played by Nathan Lane, was a show about Dalton Trumbo called Trumbo. And if you haven't seen the movie, I would recommend seeing it. He was a screenwriter. Who was during the blacklisting days, and he fought the blacklisting. And it's an amazing movie, and I had no idea there was a... This sounds like something that's good for Hyde Park Theater. Mm-hmm. One-person performance called Trumbo. Other people that did it was F. Murray Abraham, mm. Brian Dennehy, Gory Vidal, Richard Dreyfuss, Roger Rees.
Wow.
So, in good company. This is the death anniversary at age 86 of Albert Marais. He won a Tony Award for directing Man of La Mancha.
Oh.
He also directed Kismet, The Chalk mm-hmm. Garden, and Milk and Honey.
Oh, interesting.
Not Milk and Honey, but Milk and
Honey. Milk and Honey. Mm-hmm. Jerry Herman.
I have to be very clear about mm-hmm. that. In 2000... Oh, that was it. That was 2012. another death anniversary, 2014, a Miss Joan Rivers mm. died at 81. Of course, known mostly for her TV and things, but she had a pretty big theater pedigree as well. She was in Fun City. She was in Sally Marr and Her Escorts, which she authored with Neil hmm. Simon.
Interesting.
In 2015... another death anniversary. You got to be careful on September 4th.
I was going to say.
People man. Are dying. Jean Darling. Do you know who that is?
Name is very familiar.
When I Marry Mr. Snow.
That's why the name is familiar.
Yeah, she played mm-hmm. Carrie in Carousel,
yeah.
the original. Other birthdays. Paul Osborne, playwright. Richard Wright, Dick York. Okay, Dick York. Does everybody know who he was?
Bewitched. Yes.
Bewitched. So if everybody, when Bewitched was coming out as a kid, and they would put people's names in thought bubbles,
mm-hmm.
And then they showed Darren in a cartoon, and the thought bubble came up Dick York. I thought he was saying something. I didn't realize that was a person's name.
Wow.
For years, I thought that. And right. I think it wasn't until because there were two different Darrens.
Yes,
I believe
right.
he was the first.
Amazing.
Judith Ivey and James Monroe Englehart's mm-hmm. birthday all today. Oh, that's great. We're going to take a little break, and we're going to come back, and we're going to listen to an interview that we did with the person that plays Javert.
Les Miserables.
Keeping with Les Miserables. We'll be right back. Oh, this is from Urinetown. Run, Freedom, Run.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's not really. That's a lot of people don't know that that song was originally written for Urinetown.
In but, the future.
Yeah, so, okay, let's do this again. Here it is.
You gotta run, 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 freedom, run away.
We are back. You're listening to Offstage and On the Air with Elisa Sheps and today's guest co-host, Mr. Adam Roberts.
Hey, hey.
Hey, hey. We had great conversations with Maggie Gallant and Mr. Ken Webster, and I cannot wait to see the show. Now we're going to zip forward to Les Miserables, which opens a week from Tuesday here in Austin, Texas at the Bass Concert Hall. And we're running a little late on time, so I'm just going to run right into the interview that Nicole and I did with the man who plays Javert, whose name is Josh Davis. Here is that interview. Hey, we have on the telephone with us Josh Davis. He's playing Javert in the Broadway Across America production of Les Miserables. How are you, Josh?
I'm very well. It's good to talk to you guys.
It's good to talk to you. Where are you?
Currently, we actually have a little bit of a layoff right now, so I'm visiting some family in South Carolina.
South Carolina.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're on vacation. We're not from South Carolina. I'm actually from, I live in New York, but I'm from Maryland.
Is that New York City or the other one?
No, New York City.
Okay, okay. I just want to make sure.
Smaller New York.
We get it confused. So how long have you been with the tour?
I have been on the tour for 2 years, actually. It was 2 years in the beginning of August.
Wow.
That's a long time. Have you been Javert the whole time?
I have.
Wow. Yeah. Amazing.
I was cast as in the original company of the national tour.
So now, you know, anybody that knows theater knows that currently, at least on the other side of the pond, Les Mis is embroiled in controversy with the last turntable going away. Do you have any comments?
Good riddance. No, I.
Good riddance. Shame on you.
I have done Les Mis with the turntable,
uh-huh.
and I've done Les Mis without the turntable. They're both great. You know, we obviously there are some diehard turntable fans, but as far as like mechanically, the turntable is sometimes a nightmare.
Yeah.
At least when you have to take it apart and put it back together on tour. This new tour that we have is it's an amazing production. So it's all of the songs. It's the whole 3-hour beautiful show. But what we did was we bring the entire set with us. It's like 11 tractor trailers.
Yep.
There's no turntable, but there are a lot of moving parts to it. So like people, if people are still want to see like the automation magic, they are not going to be disappointed.
Sure.
And the other cool thing that we have is instead of like a flat backdrop, we have these graphics and visuals, most of which are based on, a lot of people don't know this, but Victor Hugo was also a painter as well as an author. And he did a lot of beautiful gouache and watercolor paintings. And we used a couple of his, and then we created some others based on that style. And it's just like, it just pulls you into the world when you're like, you know, through the proscenium. It's just, it's so awesome.
That's great.
Well, that's really cool. I like that how you got excited about it too, because you don't always get that from viewpoint on stage.
Yeah. No, I don't. Well, what's funny is I get to see it very close. So there's a couple times, because I'm a watercolor artist as well, and I paint on the road. So I have a pretty good appreciation for how good of an artist he was. But I always like to look at it and kind of see, you know, there's a couple times when Javert is just hanging out upstage, like, and nobody knows he's there. He's not doing anything. So I just kind of like look at the colors and see how he went about like kind of painting it. So.
He's upstage trying to figure out whether he wants to jump in the river or not.
Well, at that point, he's already made the decision. Downstage at that point.
Got it. So now, Les Mis was here in Austin. I don't know when it was. It was certainly after turntable time. So okay. Were you here before? I don't know if it was within 2 years.
No. This is the first time I've been with like the national official Les Mis tour. I've done a couple of regional productions. But I was on Broadway in a show called Beautiful, the Carole King musical.
We've heard of that one.
Okay. Yes.
So I was an original cast member of that show on Broadway. I did that for 3 years, and then I came out on the road with my dad.
I will just say this about Beautiful. It's beautiful. So actually, speaking of Beautiful, were you there when Joni Mitchell came out?
Carole King,
sorry. My God. When you get to meet my age, this will happen. When Carole King came out on stage?
If you look on YouTube and you see like Carole King visits Beautiful, we're there.
I've seen it. It's beautiful. I was crying.
Yeah. So was I. We all were crying. Yeah, we were told she wasn't going to come. So.
Yeah, anyway. I know. It was an amazing piece, and what a great experience that must have been.
I mean, so how is it to be a part of now? I mean, two shows, very distinctly different, but two shows that are very entrenched in the culture of theater and pop culture in general.
It's a little surreal in the sense, you know, because as an outsider growing up, my mom played all of her music, and I listened to Les Mis was the first show I'd ever seen as a kid. And I remember my drama teacher took us to see it in Baltimore, and I just was like blown away. It feels great, honestly. It's an honor to be a part of it, and it was an honor to be able to work and help create that character in Beautiful, and also then to be able to be Javert and help to create a different version of Javert that, you know, the same old like lovable Javert that you know. But
he's so warm and fuzzy, that Javert.
He is. He just wants to cuddle him. That's probably what he needs. He needs a little cuddling.
Probably does.
Right.
Maybe we'd have a different outcome.
He would. It wouldn't be as long.
It wouldn't be as long. Okay, prisoner, you're good.
All right. He's like, nah. I'm just going to stay here and hang out.
You're fine. Well, awesome. So have you been to Austin before?
You know what? I have not been to Austin, and I have never been more excited. And I'm not just saying that. Like, I've never been more excited to come. I've been to, like, Houston and San Antonio and El Paso, all these great cities. I've never been to Austin, so I'm very excited to come down there.
Are you looking forward to anything specific when you're here?
The bats? I don't know.
The bats are good. Cool. They're actually really, really cool.
I would like to get out and see a little bit of the geography. And I do want to go downtown and for some city nightlife too.
Yeah,
shenanigans are fun.
Well, we have the beautiful hill country area, and the winery areas here are really, really gorgeous. And of course, they won't let you out of the city limits without having breakfast tacos and or barbecue.
Okay, that's great. Well, we came through the south earlier, and I like I had my fair share of barbecue, but I think it's been like 6 or 7 months since we've been
back. It's the one thing that Texas does well.
Okay.
And actually, it's very different. You guys were
sure in there's a couple of things.
Yes. I'm sure you were in Houston. You were in Houston, right? Is that where you were earlier?
We were in Houston, Dallas, another McKellen. We were just in Fort Worth.
Yeah. All very different food in all the different cities, even though we're all Texas. Yep. So you'll get.
So what is Austin known for then? Is it breakfast tacos?
Are the big thing, but it's all different. Well, we are looking forward to seeing you here. I'll definitely be in the audience when you're here on the Tuesday night performance.
We will hear the people
all right.
Sing.
You should all come back. Not everyone who's listening come back stage, but you guys come back stage and say hi.
We will. Go back to your vacation, and we'll see you when you're back here and working.
Sounds good.
Great. Take care.
Thank you.
All right, thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
That was Josh Davis. He plays Javert in Broadway Across America's production of Les Miserables, playing September 10th through 15th at Bass Concert Hall. For more information, you may visit austin.broadway.com.
In your multitude. All right. That was a good interview. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to seeing that show. You and I had a little discussion off air about the merits of the role of Javert, and we differ.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of merit.
And I think none.
Well, that's us, isn't
so,
it?
So there you go. That's what makes horse races.
That's what makes the world go round.
Well, Adam, I'm so happy you were on the show.
I am so thrilled you
invited
me.
And you're
going
to join us backstage, yes?
I
so
am.
We can learn a little bit more about you
absolutely.
As well. We'll keep the conversation. And Maggie will be back with us as well. So, folks, you can find us on Twitter. You can find us on Stitcher. You can find us on the iTunes podcast store. So that way you get to see and hear our backstage at Austin. Mm-hmm. We want you to do that. If you're listening on the terrestrial radio, Austin Monitor News is next, starring the incomparable Tracy Schultz, who did not come to my theater last week. Just thought I'd say.
We did establish that.
If you're listening on the podcast, Backstage at Offstage is next, and it's going to be great because we love it when only a very few people here, and we've got a nice small intimate group. We can learn a lot. So
yes.
Going out, this is from the New Oklahoma, and you can hear how this version is different from previous versions. I really want to see it. We'll see you next week when we look at what's happening offstage and on the air.
Oklahoma, where the wind comes sweeping down the plain and the waving wheat.
The curtain has just come down on Sound Man the Musical, right story of a young man who tried to make a living doing a show by Rodgers and Hammerstein that everybody loved, and he made it different and nobody loved it. That's the show.
I know what show you're talking about.
I do too. Anyway, we have left the theater. We're backstage. We're sitting out here by the dumpsters. Today we are boiling because it's 113
so
degrees
hot
outside.
Out
and it smells lovely. But here we are lucky enough to have Mr. Adam Roberts
hey.
With us. Now, you've been backstage with us before.
Many times.
Many times.
This dumpster is very familiar.
And Maggie Gallant.
Newbie.
Newbie. So, Maggie, where the heck are you from?
Well, not from these parts.
No, we could tell that.
Actually, I was born in a very small English village in Kent in England. Hmm. But
where
when I go home, it's about 50 miles
is
from
Kent
London.
Like the Midlands or no?
Good Lord, no.
No, God, no.
It's the southeast.
Oh. Okay, well, that's what I was going to say.
The southerners. No, but when I go home, of course, everyone says that I sound like an American now, which is very awkward, so I belong in neither place, I feel.
You know what? I got that when I grew up in, I don't tell people, but I grew up in Texas. I moved to New York at 18. And when I would go home to Texas, they'd say, you sound like a New Yorker. And when I'd tell people in New York I grew up in Texas, they'd say, yeah, you sound like a Texan. Can't win.
I can hear it.
Yeah, I don't.
I can hear it.
I don't.
Yeah, I can't get the, you sound American. I'm like, on what word specifically?
So did you do theater in London?
Nope. I was a very corporate girl. I was in public relations.
Oh, yes. We call it PR.
Well,
it's too bad Nicole isn't here because that's what she does
that's
now
right.
for a living.
Well, you can take degrees in PR, which is not something you could do when I was in college.
What made you want to tread the boards, as they say?
Well, so when I came here, I left my very...
Came here
very,
co-op?
Very... to Austin.
Oh, okay, got it.
With my green card husband. So when I came here, I wanted to do something different, but I had left my very important corporate job and everything, and I just needed to do something that Eric was not going to do, my husband. Mm-hmm. And so I went into stand-up comedy and mm-hmm. took a class. And that's where I started off.
So, yeah. So you mentioned that in the show earlier that you come from stand-up comedy. I think of all the things out there with which to do in front of an audience, I think it takes the most courage to do stand-up.
But and I agree. When I look at it now, if I thought about going back, I wouldn't do it. But when you're in it, it's just it's what you do. And I was more terrified of doing improv than I was of stand-up, because you could at least take a little note card up there and put it on your stool.
But on improv, at least the audience is cheering for you. When you're a stand-up, the audience does not want you to win.
Oh, they're, yeah, especially.
They don't want you to win. Right. It's just frightening.
And especially when I started out, and I didn't have a huge career in it. I mean, I was, you know, fairly inexperienced. But there were very few women doing comedy.
Still are, relative to...
Well, yeah.
Relative to...
But it was all sort of younger guys who were in their 20s.
Yeah.
And then I just sort of started to feel like the old woman of stand-up. I was like, ooh.
Now, did you do all that in Austin?
Yes.
That, okay. And where did you start your training?
The Cap City Comedy and the famous Velveeta Room on 6th.
I did not realize the Cap City. Did you just go up and do it, or did you take some classes?
There was a 4-week class, and then there was a little showcase. And of course, you do the showcase, and you bring all your friends there,
yes.
And you just think you're the most brilliant comedian ever, and this is your great new thing. And then you go back to do an open mic, and it's terrible.
So now, Adam, you do every time I talk to you about things, you always come up with something else that you have done that I'm always amazed with. Have you done stand-up comedy?
Oh, never. Never.
Never would.
No. Do it.
Do it.
Do it. So, Maggie, do you not that anymore?
No.
No.
And then I used to go down to to go down to the Velveeta Room on 6th, which is probably the most brutal place to ever do comedy, because it's just people who are being sort of hawked in off the street.
Yeah,
sure.
Bring her in, make a grin. That was the sort of guy I was.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Shout out to Michael Park to the Velveeta Room.
Yeah.
But yes, and then it was just all just the other comedians at the back of the room who would just laugh every time you started bombing. So, yeah.
Now, have you watched, I don't know whether it got picked up again, but there's a series about comedians in the 70s, stand-ups. It's, what's it called? Oh, I forgot what it's called, but I watched it. Anyway, it's the end of the story. So, well, take us through from stand-up to working in a theater.
So then... Well, then I think I aged out of stand-up comedy, if that's possible.
I don't think that's... Let's talk to Joan Rivers.
I sort of had to go...
Who, by the way, died on this day.
I think I should have waited another 20 years, and then I could go as a sort of older woman and be hilarious, you know, the inappropriate old lady. But sort of in my mid-30s, I was like, this is not for me. And so that's when I went to the Frontera Fest Short Fringe, and they were like, you just pay your money, and you can do this. I was like, sounds great. So I wrote my little... 25-minute version of Hot Dogs at the Eiffel Tower, and that's where I started off.
So do you have any desire to either write a piece that's a multi-character narrative arc, or either perform in a piece like that?
I have an ambition to write a multi-character piece. I've done it with other characters. I mean, I've done a show, I did a show about the aftermath of Princess Diana's death, and I had, you know, 8 different character monologues. So I wrote those, but, you know, part of me, I like writing things when I can then get on the stage. It's sort of very narcissistic.
Sure.
Really. That's my opportunity to get on the stage.
Well, no, as I just learned, not so much me.
And I've also proven from working with Ken that it takes something for me to actually learn the words as they are indeed written on the script, which is sort of important if you're doing another playwright's work.
Yes, true. That's, that's tough. So, what do you like to do outside of artistic endeavors? Do you have a passion outside of theater?
So I have a passion for, I work a lot with, as we were just saying earlier, with seniors. So I'll go into memory care communities, senior communities. I'll take music-based programs, cultural programs, go and talk about different aspects of British history. And I love that work because I care a lot about the activities that go on in our...
So are you going as Maggie Gallant? Are you there as part of a nonprofit?
No, I just go as myself. myself. I am the British woman. That is my business. That just came about because nobody could ever remember my name, but they would say to the activity, oh, get that British woman back in.
Well, it's important. You know, one of the things that I want to do at Ground Floor Theater, and it's probably going to be the season after next, is I want to try to find a piece that features people of a certain age so that there's not a lot of really good pieces with meaty, vibrant roles for people after the age of 45 or 50.
Right.
Have you seen where MTI, which is the company that licenses musicals, you know, they have junior versions and now they're starting to have senior versions.
And I don't know how I feel about it.
I don't know. I'd have to
see
it. There
was just an article this week that I was reading about that. And by MTI, Adam means Music Theater International.
I do.
Adam, then what new little tidbit of your life can you divulge that we don't know anything about?
Well, first of all, I have to say that I love that you're from Kent because that's my middle name. So there's this little circle there.
So it is the Garden of England.
Oh, well, I like that.
Well, isn't that redundant unto itself?
Right, that's right. new tidbit. Well, I am really excited right now to be working on this new Alan Robertson musical.
Let's talk about Tilt. That.
So Tilt, which is the theater company that I co-founded with Gail Dalrymple and Robert Pearson back in 2013 now, which is crazy to think. We're ending our fifth anniversary season with a musical that's called Pandora, Life Outside the Box. For those who are unfamiliar with Tilt, it's a company that is... it employs adult actors with disabilities to perform in various productions. And now we've gotten to the point where we're paying our company members to do work that is outside the stage, which is really cool. So this is a musical that we were able to commission from Alan thanks to an NEA, National Endowment on the Arts grant. And as much as I love all of Alan Robertson's musicals, this is my favorite. We really hit the jackpot with this one. It's amazing.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing that. Of course, you're doing it at Ground Floor Theater, we think is great. We typically don't talk about shows that we're doing on this part of the show, but let's do for real quick. Tell folks when it is, how much it is. We don't have the same rules as we have on the other.
Yeah, it's the it runs the last weekend in October and the first weekend in November, and it'll be at Ground Floor. I'm actually not sure. Gail, who is our executive director, and I are talking about different options for tickets and things right now, but we're hoping within the next week to have that all out there to the world.
But you'll be able to find things at tiltperformance.org. There'll also be a link at groundfloortheater.org.
Awesome.
Yep. That's great. We love Tilt.
Well, and we love Ground Floor Theater.
And we do need, I'll just say this right here on Backstage at Offstage, we need to book time for Pandora to be on this show.
Love it. Can't wait.
We don't have it. We don't have you on the books right now.
Yep.
But one of the things that I'm sure we talk about it whenever you're here backstage, but the thing that that amazes me about Adam is the varied amount of hats that he wears. So we know he's an artistic director and a creator of a company. He was the artistic director of Austin Jewish Theater. He is a composer. He is a musical director. He is a choreographer, which I find amazing. I don't know why I do, but I do. a director. I mean, he's everything. Do you knit costumes as well?
I do nothing technically related. Not one thing.
do you have a master's? Yeah. And we talked because your thesis was on
Parade.
Right.
Which we did together.
We did
our first production together.
Yeah, we have have done. Oh, and actually one thing I would like to talk about. We'll bring this up to everything. Do you do anything with musicals?
I do not, apart from the programs that I take into the community. Right. So I did a lot of research on musicals.
Well, this is interesting. A young man that Adam knows, Creighton
Mensch,
is doing his dissertation on local musical theater,
ethnomusicology.
Thank you, ethnomusicology. Anyway, so he interviewed me. Some of the things that he brought up I found quite amazing in terms of he would talk about things he was talking about other people. But we spent a lot of time talking about the people snubbing either musicals or snubbing non-musicals. And this thing between those two classes of theater and how... how some people look down upon the other. And it angers me when people look down upon any art form, really. But to me, there's nothing wrong with a good musical, and there's nothing wrong with a good straight play. And there's also nothing wrong with lighthearted, you know, check your brains at the door musicals.
Right. Absolutely.
But when we talk about parades, we spend a lot of time talking about the musicals that Ground Floor Theater does, which typically are a little bit more heady than a normal musical. You're usually left thinking. And that's one of the things I talked about, the current contemporary musicals,
yeah,
and even some of the old musicals. Oklahoma's famous for turning the tide on.
Oh yeah,
on the way
Showboat Oklahoma.
Showboat. Yeah. So all of these shows have a lot more. I want to say some people would say substance. I could argue that a lighthearted musical could have substance. Shrek has substance, if you ask me.
Sure.
But anyway, how do y'all feel about that controversy? I'll speak your language.
I mean, I agree. I think any, you know, when you try to create division and one says, you know, something is better than the other, it just doesn't fly with me at all. And I mean, I didn't really know a lot, I didn't have a lot of musical history. And then when I was taking these programs into the communities, I did a lot of research because I was telling people about the history and, you know, the Rodgers and Hammerstein era in the first part and then, you know, going into the 60s and 70s and beyond. And it was fascinating. When I research these programs, I go down rabbit holes a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, I learn way more than I actually need to know. But when you actually look at what it takes to craft these musicals and the thinking behind it and the themes, it was fascinating to me. So I don't have a huge breadth of knowledge, but that sort of attempt to create division is... it just doesn't play.
Yeah, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, I will, to quote my good friend and colleague Ginger Morris, who says this all the time and is also within the musical theater world and the straight play world as far
somewhat
as that's concerned. Yeah, right. I think there is a big difference between preference and opinion. And, I think that a lot of people don't necessarily prefer performance art, don't necessarily prefer musical theater or prefer plays, but that is a very different stance than an opinion. That one of them is invalid in some way or lesser than
right.
in some way. And I think you've seen, as you've said, Lisa, a conflation over the past, you know, few years of these heady musicals that also exist sort of parallel to maybe some musicals that really are more of those sort of like check your brains at the door.
Sure.
Neither of those is better or worse. I mean, you know, the musical theater having grown up in, you know, very much so in America in sort of post-war, and the function that it often served, this dual function of thinking about society and also about escapism, I think, is something that has been a treasure that has continued along musical theater history and continues to. Yeah.
The other little controversial thing that he brought up that I sort of want to talk about, it made me think a little bit, and he was asking me about the difference between community theater and professional theater, and that's fraught. There is no direct line between, but there are people that will think that professional theater would only be like the only professional theater in this town would be Zach because it's a
right
equity theater, maybe Austin Playhouse. But I would argue that's not the case. If you pay and treat people professionally, it's always good. Where do y'all sit on the community versus professional theater lines?
I mean, again, it's just the quality of the production, isn't it? I mean, if you're talking about community theater, then I think about my childhood and growing up in a village and we had the Lenham Village Players. Yeah. And it was a sort of, you know, the ladies from the ladies from the church and some of the right. bell ringers, you know, who right. sort of gather together. But, you know, professional theater is a good, it's a solid, you know, great production. And it doesn't matter what venue it's in or what the ticket pricing is. If it's good theater, it's good theater. So again, it just bugs me, and it's usually people who comment on that and not always people who've seen
sure
both productions. Uh-huh. Yeah. They've seen one and they're making a judgment call on the other because they have that preference.
Well, I think I would say two thoughts about it. One is that I certainly have myself attended many community theater productions that I have found more professional in quality than professional so-called professional mm-hmm. productions. So I think that, you know, again, that's one of those sort of like opinion things to subjective things also in terms of that. But I often think back when I was writing for the Chronicle, I did a piece on season selection and how different artistic directors sort of work with boards or on their own or however to select seasons. And one of the questions I asked each of these artistic directors was, you know, how do you classify your theater company, community, professional, semi-professional? What does that mean? And Norman over at Different Stages gave a really great answer, I thought. And he said community, because all theater should be of its community. And I thought that was a really great, hey, Norman, shout out to Norman. I thought that was a really great answer to that question.
That is a great answer. And mm-hmm. I struggle because I, like a lot of other people, you know, have fallen to the idea that community theater is somehow less than, mm-hmm. And very much like your Lithium Community Players or whatever it was. But I've decided I think I want to coin a new term, professional community theater.
Interesting.
Ah,
interesting.
Because theaters like Norman's, like mine, like Ken's, like yeah. all of it, we all pay our people.
Right.
So by that definition, we are professional theaters. Mm-hmm. But you know, am I paying people a living wage? No, I can't do that yet. So I sort of like the idea as Norman, and good for Norman to embrace the word community. I think it's important to do that.
Promunity theater.
Promunity. This is a promunity theater.
Well, but I also think there's an aspect when I think about Ground Floor, you know, I think that you're so missionally aligned in the work that you do. I mean, I've seen you curate both your rentals and the work that you yourself do in such a way that the mission is always at the center. And you've said, I don't think this is for us, when you think that it's not missionally aligned. You know, some renters or whatever. And I think that that's awesome. And I think that, like what Norman was saying, I think a theater can be of its community.
Absolutely.
You are for communities that don't have another opportunity oftentimes. And that's your mission. And I think that Tilt, you know, we are by and for and hopefully evangelizing for, in a way, another community. We also pay our actors. And I think that by that definition, it's hard to separate. And maybe that's good. Maybe it's good that it's hard to separate.
I think it is good. But also in terms of being mission driven versus professional community theater, those are mutually exclusive.
Sure.
You know, so hopefully in you know, 20 years when Tilt is competing against Ground Floor Theater for a Tony Award, we will talk about our mission-driven program.
That's right. Exactly. That's right.
Well, thank you guys so much for coming. This has been a great
conversation.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's been a blast.
I do apologize for the heat and the smell of the dumpsters, but it's what it is.
Yeah.
All right. It's September.
That's right.
Cool weather.
Reminds you of the city.
Exactly. Thank you guys for coming backstage.
Thank you. Enjoyed it.
Bye.
So you're back in the dumpster. Well, that's like a metaphor. Everyone has a dumpster, a stumbling block they can't ignore. But to fight it makes you stronger. And next time you might